Good afternoon, everyone. I think we are ready to, at least I am ready to start, hope you are too. Welcome to the museum's brand bag lecture, lunch lecture series. Those of you who are actually eating, bon appetit for everyone. The others who are not planning to eat, just welcome. My name is Agnes Beretz, as you may know, and I will talk about Holocaust, kind of, you know, Holocaust remembrance, works of contemporary art which relate to the collective memory of the Holocaust. And as you can see, there is a hearing loop system installed in the room, so if you do have hearing device, you just need to kind of switch that on and you will hear me very well. Speaking about hearing, am I okay? Can you hear me really well with this? Okay, good. So, let me start. In his 2004 book, In the Shadow of No Towers, Art Spiegelman evokes his father's struggle with remembering, and I will quote, "I remember my father trying to describe that the smoke in Auschwitz smelled like, I remember my father trying to describe what the smoke in Auschwitz smelled like. The closest he got was telling me it was indescribable," end of quote. Spiegelman's words point to the difficulty of representing and remembering trauma, raising a whole array of questions. How can the smell of Auschwitz could be expressed through images and words? And if indescribable, can it be represented at all? How can experience of the father can be transmitted and conveyed to the son? That is, how the testimony of the witness can be turned to the secondary witness and then maybe to others? Speaking of primary and secondary witnesses leads us to the necessary differentiation between images related to the history and memory of the Holocaust. Images in historical archives, primary documents such as films and photographs, provide us with a visual record of the Holocaust. And to start this differentiation, first I would like to show you some of these archival materials, primary sources, just to provide you with a very basic kind of visual vocabulary of the events. Some of them will be very well known for you, I guess. And the first will be two drawings realized by survivors. That would be the first group within the primary documents. In this case, this is David Oller, Birkenau drawing, realized shortly after the liberation of the camp. And Fernand van Horen, a Belgian Jewish man who was who spent a couple of months in Flossenbürg, and after the liberation of the camp, he kind of created a whole series of mostly drawings representing, or not really representing, just basically documenting what he seen there. Second group, of course, would be those Nazi propaganda materials which turned into kind of primary documents of the Holocaust. This is actually not a Nazi propaganda material. It's an aerial photograph showing Auschwitz. And it was executed, as you see, it was end of May 1944 by South African kind of aerial photographers, planes kind of flying over the camp. Here are some of the Nazi propaganda or Nazi documentation, the very, very well-known iconic photographs of the so-called Auschwitz album, which were taken, the shots were taken by two SS officers, and on the photographs shot in the end of May or June 1944, you can see the Hungarian Jews arriving to Auschwitz. Here you can see the elderly on the ramps before the selection process, after which they were sent to the gas chamber or they were kind of mass executed. The next image will be a rather graphic one, this and the one after this only. So please, if you don't feel like having a look at them, then don't look at them. We are in Buchenwald in Germany, not very far from Weimar. And these images were not done by Nazi officers, but by the US military officers who took these images after arriving to the camp, after immediately after the liberation of the camps. Second one will be also rather graphic here. And the last one, which still belongs to this category of primary documents, is a very well-known iconic photograph taken by Margaret Burke White, who herself was the member of the US military personnel And what you see here, these are the Buchenwald political prisoners, also shortly after the liberation of the camp by the US military forces. And Margaret Birkwise's photograph, as you see, was published in the May 7 issue of Life magazine in 1945 with the following inscription. I will quote, "Dead men will have indeed died in vain if live men refuse to look at them." End of quote. Kind of presenting, kind of validating the publication of these images. Not necessarily this one, because this is tough, because you see the gazes of the prisoners, but also some other more kind of, you know, graphic images, the very idea of the obligation to remember, right? So that was the validation, the justification to show the images. Okay. One more thing about these photographs or drawings, that each of these images show you the before or after image, right? So they show you what happens before the murder, the assassination of the deported people, Jews, political prisoners, gypsies, homosexual, and so on. And then you see the after images, but you actually don't see the core event. And regarding this kind of specificity of Holocaust documentation, I would like to quote from a recently published article written by Katalin Orban. It is entitled Trauma and Visuality, and it is about Art Spiegelman. It was published in Representations. So let me quote this. "The mass destruction of life in the Holocaust is functionally invisible insofar as the idea of its efficiency was predicated on a negative or deferred visibility. Removal from sight into enclosed and at times underground spaces played an important role in the operation of the entire machinery of extermination, from ghettos through sealed boxcars through camps. There is a visual black hole at the core of this event, which is not only a contingent feature of the process of efficient mass murder as designed by the perpetrators, but also a normative and positive invisibility in response to the Holocaust, whose status as a limit event is connected to some version of Bilderverbot." End of quote. The Bilderverbot, the prohibition of images, takes us back to where we started, to the understanding of the Holocaust as an event which, being beyond representation, cannot be expressed or understood neither through language nor image. Adorno's statement about the barbaric nature of writing poetry after Auschwitz is the best-known example of this prohibition. Silence and blindness imposed as an ethical obligation functions to prevent the vulgarization of the Holocaust singularity. Yet there is also the duty and the moral responsibility to remember, to know one's past, even if this past, as it often happens, is a burden, a chain of events inscribed by shock, pain, and trauma. It is not by chance that remembering it brings to mind the Freudian terms of mourning and melancholy, working through and acting out. Those who created after images and monuments dealing with the Holocaust complied with the obligation to remember without forgetting the limited possibility to do so. This lecture will consider a second group of images, images, installations, and memorials which were created and built during the past decades by secondary or tertiary witnesses, Jewish or non-Jewish artists alike. As the process of memory is always mediated through telling and retelling, remembering and forgetting, these works are also shaped by historical collective memories, learned knowledges, and through the experience of others. As cultural artifacts, they do not possess, rather negotiate and problematize notions and functions of the documents and the archive, as well as the relations between memory and history. They do not answer, but investigate the question of what can be remembered and what can be known, exploring how memory and history interact and overwrite each other. Instead of providing historical narratives, they reenact the trauma, providing what Ernst von Alpen identified as the so-called Holocaust effect, and relinquishing modes of witnessing and documentation, trace what the art historian Dora Appel described, quote-unquote, memory effects. So we have Holocaust effects and memory effects, and this is the second group kind of relating to what I will be showing you today. Okay. Many of the projects to be discussed here also relate to the recent upsurge of memory studies and to what Norman Finkelstein, in a book of 2003, called the Holocaust industry, quote-unquote Holocaust industry. The growing number of Holocaust-related artworks, including some of those which I'm about to show you, was motivated by those debates and controversies which were followed, on the one hand, the publication of revisionist Holocaust studies and, in certain cases, Holocaust denials, and on the other hand, the so-called historical strikes. That's the German expression for the dispute of the historians, which occurred in the second half of the 1980s in Germany, and which brought into kind of public visibility the question of Holocaust interpretation, asking whether the Holocaust should be understood as a unique, singular event, or whether it should be understood as something which is in relation to the other 20th century or 19th century genocides, such as Rwanda, and, you know, we can go on, Cambodia, Vietnam, and so on. So this is the context of these contemporary works of art, which I will be kind of showing to you, in this second group of Holocaust-related images. And the first artist whose work you will be seeing shortly is Christian Boltanski. Boltanski was born in France in 1944, and he has been working with collections of photographic images, archives, whether public or private archives, since the early 1970s. Playing on the relation of photography to death and recalling its origin as a photochemical trace, an index of something or someone absent, Boltanski uses black and white images of the mostly Jewish victims of the Holocaust, who, like specters, haunt and remind us of their murder and disappearance. This spectral space, this space which is essentially about the impossibility to remember or to evoke, is something which characterizes most of his installations. And as you see, or them referring to photographs, he builds installation out of archival images, black and white images. Here, what you see is in the chapel of the Salpêtrière Hospital in Paris, and the Children of Dijon, based on the public documentation photographs of children, Jewish children, who probably all of them disappeared. We don't always know. That's something which makes the installation so haunting and so kind of, you know, problematic, that of course with photography you always have this effect of mummy effect. This is André Bazin's term. Whenever you see a photograph of someone, there is this always this question, is the person still alive? What happened to him or her? That belongs to every photograph. Looking at the photographs of children, Jewish children, in, you know, taken in Dijon during the war years or immediately before the years of the Second World War, enhances and dramatizes this question, this mummy effect of photography. You can also see that Boltanski building these, kind of creating these wall monuments or wall memorials or installations uses lights, thus kind of turning or bringing into a very obvious spiritual, almost religious dimension to the act of remembrance and mourning. And the lights kind of relating to those rituals of mourning when you light a candle. Here is another one when you see archives. The archives were from 1987. It's a pseudo-archive, again, based on photographic documentation, mostly children. You see that he makes it evident that he reuses, rephotographs, and crops the original images, because you see that there are differences in the scale and the scale of each and every image. You can also see in certain cases that the image was taken out of a snapshot, a family snapshot. Right? So there is this mediation, recycling of the image itself, and yet again, the uses of light kind of dramatizing the effect of the photographic display. I would like to quote him, and I will quote, this is what he said about his kind of, you know, aim with playing with the memory, photography, and death. I'm interested in what I call little memory, an emotional memory on an everyday knowledge, the contrary of the memory with a capital M that is preserved in history books. This little memory, which for me is what makes us unique, is extremely fragile, and it disappears with death. This loss of identity, this equalization in forgetting, is very difficult to accept. End of quote. Wanting to oppose the equalization in forgetting, as well as the prohibition of images, he creates wall-mounted monuments and memorials. And one more thing which I haven't mentioned so far is that each of these monuments or memorials, the photographic installation, basically kind of shows these photographic images, the cropped, fragmented photographs, as ruins or relics, yet again kind of enforcing the spiritual dimension of the display. And site specificity is quite important here in the monument, Odessa monument. You know, location, it's not just about giving faces to somehow, you know, identify or give face to the unknown mass murdered victims of the Holocaust, but also kind of specifying the location to make it topographic in a certain sense. So it's the same desire kind of motivates him to specify that children, these faces, here, there, right? Okay. The next project takes us to Vienna, the Gymnasium Schass, which was a Jewish gymnasium, a Jewish high school in Vienna. And this is a book, an artist book, because that's, I also wanted to show you something which is not installation, but an artist book, which Boltanski created many of these books. The gymnasium photographs, what you see, he rephotographed and blurred the photographs almost to the edge of unrecognizability, right? The very likeness, the basis of photographic image is being partially relinquished. Again, this ghost-like spectral aspect of the photographic image, photography becomes visually a device of disappearance. And what you see, these are photogravures. The book itself contains photogravures, and the gravures were based on a 1931 yearbook of this Jewish school in Vienna. And of course, here again, we have the indeterminacy that we don't know what happened to these people. We have absolutely no idea. You know, there is a very good chance that they all died. And the question kind of lingers with us. Here is another image, yet again the faces taken out of the school portrait. Okay. Boltanski's work, and this is what I'm showing to you right now, since this desire to give faces, to identify, can also remind us to the whole of the names in the Yad Vashem Institute in Jerusalem. I'm showing you the dome of the Yad Vashem, when you can see photographs, you know, either the giving names, specifying names, or giving, you know, faces to the victims. That's a very well-known and quite often used device, not just in the Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, but also in many Holocaust museums all over in Europe and America. Those Holocaust museums, which are also kind of emerged as a response to this kind of memory industry in the 1990s. Okay, the next work will be not operating with photographs, but on the other hand, with pieces of clothing. I'm showing to you Reserve from 1990, and the work itself echoes the warehouses in the camps, which again become part of the camp museums. In many places in Germany and in Poland. And these clothing, these pieces of clothing, of course, are not original pieces. Boltanski was collecting pieces of clothing in thrift stores, you know, in consignment shops. But the very idea that the clothing itself, the piece of cloth itself, like a photograph, functions as an indexical trace of a disappeared body. It functions as an empty shell. It somehow materializes absence and the lack of the persons. The person itself kind of bridges the photographic work with this work that I'm showing to you right now. And on the other hand, of course, here again, the motif of collecting, accumulating, trying to get traces, information. That's also one of the underlying principle of the work. The last project, which I would like to show you, also kind of trying to give you a sense of the scope of Boltanski's practice, is a site-specific installation in Berlin, which he created in 1990. The exact address of the house is, it's called the Missing House, and it's 1516 Groß Hamburger Straße in Berlin. He was commissioned to do this project. In 1990, there was a citywide project in Berlin, the recently unified Berlin. It was called the Endlichkeit, that der Freiheit, the finitude of freedom. And many artists were invited to create something site-specific in the city, not just Boltanski, but also artists like Hans Hacke or Ronnie Horn. Most of the projects were removed after a certain amount of time, except, you know, Boltanski's is still there, according to my best knowledge. And Missing House was resurged. It's, as you see, an empty house which was bombed in April 1945. So it's an empty lot. Located in the former Jewish district of the former East Berlin. And here you can see the wall of the neighboring houses. You can also see plaques with names there. Boltanski and his students and assistants kind of researched the history of the house, and they installed, you see, every floor. They figured out that who lived in which period, on what floor, on which floor, and they created these memorial plaques all along the wall, kind of indicating the exact location of the floor, the name of the inhabitants, the period during which he or she lived there, and also their occupation. You can see that basically, I would like to go back for one single second here, that the missing house also a disruption in Berlin's history and also in the history of Europe. It's something which is missing. It's a split, you know, it's a split space, a space which is not there, which divides two houses, a kind of missing link. And just the empty house can function really as a metaphor for the history of Berlin, which itself was split, divided, divisioned, and also the history of Europe and the European Jewry, which was broken, ruptured, and split during the Holocaust. So already the site has this metaphorical kind of, you know, meaning, quite obviously so. So let's come back to these plaques. You can see that we can actually read who is there. There is a woman called, whose name is Budislavski, and she was, she lived there between 33 and 42, and she was dealing with, she was a poultry merchant, probably goose or chicken. And there is a gentleman whose name is Portaset, and who obviously was not Jewish, because otherwise he couldn't be still in this house in Berlin in 1945. And he was an employed, salaried employee, probably a clerk or something, Angestellter. Okay. The house functions basically as a lieu de mémoire, as a place of memory. This is the expression of Pierre Nora, a French historian, and also brings together public space and private lives. The very idea that one house can reflect private and collective memory is also, some of you might remember, Georges Perec, quite fantastic novel. It is called Life, a User's Manual. And in this, Georges Perec, a Jewish, French-Jewish writer, kind of talks about the history of a house, the private kind of memories or happenings or occurrences of the people in a house. And the house itself becomes a metaphor, a symbol of a whole community of the Paris of a given period. Here again, the missing house becomes a kind of symbolic container which can depict in fragments the collective memory of those who lived there or lived in Berlin during the Second World War. Something quite interesting, despite the obvious relations of Boltanski's work to the Holocaust, you know, despite the fact that he evokes and remembers things which are related to the Holocaust, he's very much reluctant to frame them in the context of the Second World War. As he repeatedly and very often kind of, you know, stated, and I quote him, "My work is not about the camps," end of quote. The next artist is Shimon Ati, and his work is certainly not about the camps, but the disappearance, about the disappearance of the Berlin Jewish population. In 1991, the 38-year-old American artist moved from Northern California to Germany, to Berlin. Confronted with the ruins of the Jewish past in the streets of Berlin, he started to work on a series of slide projections, combining the medium of installation and photography in a way which is quite similar to the way of Boltanski's work. He projected black and white archival images to the buildings of Berlin's pre-war Jewish quarter, known as the Scheunenviertel. Then he photographed the slide projections and in 1994 published them in a book which was called The Writing on the Wall. And what I'm showing to you, these are photographs, kind of color photographs taken out of this 1994 book project. And you can see the buildings in Berlin, and you can see the black and white archival photographs, images, again, coming from private and public archives, projected onto the facade of these half-ruined buildings. Employing devices which recall Boltanski's visual strategies and use of archival photographic materials, Ati's works on site, further expanding the topographic character that we have already seen in the French artist works. Here I'm referring to the Odessa project or the Dijon children project when I say site specificity or, you know, kind of specificity of location. Similarly to the politically charged projections of Krzysztof Wodzisko, which were staged on the streets of New York in the 1980s, Attis' Berlin work transforms public space into a place of commemoration, and appropriating the medium of billboard and advertisement creates a phantasmagorical and transient monument. Looking at his images, we are reminded that the past is created and constituted in the present. The walls of the buildings, formerly housing the Ostjuden, the Jews who arrived to Berlin from the east, are bearing the traces of many, many pasts. Located in the former East Berlin, they are marked by the German past of Nazi totalitarianism and the recent past of the communist dictatorship in the GDR. And I'm showing you two images which kind of depicting the same location, the exact same house. Here you can see one part of the house and the former Jewish residence kind of projected over the ruined kind of, you know, building in East Berlin in 1992. And the other shows you the other side of the house, where Ati projected the image of a former kosher butcher shop and a laundry onto the building. And let me just show you again, there is an inscription, a graffiti, an East Berlin graffiti on the facade of the building. It says that what the war has spared does not survive in socialism, which brings this kind of, you know, double memory aspect of the work. First, you know, the disappearance of the Jews, that is the Nazi past, and then after the division of Berlin, we have the memory of the East, memory of East Berlin, the communist regime, and those traces also written, literally written on the wall of the building. While Otti was working on the project, the former Scheuernviertel went through, this Jewish district, went through a major gentrification. As the artist recalled, and I quote, "After the fall of the Berlin Wall, it became the new chic quarter and frontier for many West Berliners. Within the course of only a few years, block after block of houses and buildings in the Scheuernviertel has become completely transformed. Most have been entirely renovated, others have been transformed into trendy bars and restaurants. As a result, the district has become almost unrecognizable, even in the few years since the writing on the wall project was realized in 1992-1993. This recent gentrification of the former Jewish, then former East Berlin district, kind of gives a third historical layer to the photographs that we are looking into. The ephemeral monument of Berlin's long-dead Jews and the East German past thus involuntarily obtained yet another layer of meaning and memory, attesting the material conditions of the cityscapes in the aftermath of unification. In Atti's images, similarly to Boltanski's missing house, Berlin, the ruined and divided city, acts as both a place of remembrance and a place to remember. The overlapping of the images create a palimpsest-like structure composed of architecture and photography, wall and image, present and past. The title, Writing on the Wall, appears like a reenacted testimony, a warning against oblivion, and evoking the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, also as a plea of mourning. Bless you. According to James Young, a scholar best known for this work on Holocaust memory and art, Otis' images are, and I will quote, "beautiful and chilling, slightly exhilarating and depressing. They inspire longing and fear, hope and despair," end of quote. Yet, at the same time, one cannot escape to see these pictures as melodramatic spectacles and dreamlike commodities. Both Boltanski and Otti have been very strongly occasionally criticized for their elegiac approach and for their aestheticization of melancholy. The affectivity and the dramatic overtone of their images stems from their use of the photographic image, lending an effect of immediacy and strikingness to their work, which, in turn, cannot always resist the spectacularization of absence, death, and history. And I'm showing you the last one. Okay. None of these disapprovers have, or for that matter, could have been directed against Archspiegelman's mouse. Born in Stockholm, Spiegelman immigrated to the United States with his parents in 1968. Joining the comics movement, he became a regular contributor to various underground publications, including Real Pulp, Young Lust, and Bizarre Sex. With Bill Griffith, he co-founded Arcade, an influential comic strip in 1980, and with his wife, Françoise Mouly, he started the magazine Row. It was in the 1980 issue of Row magazine that Spiegelman published the first part of Mouse, a survivor's tale, his comic book about trying to come to terms with the story of the Holocaust as experienced by his father, Vladek. Not a story about Auschwitz, but a tale of Mauschwitz. Mouse won the Pulitzer Prize in 1992. Spiegelman's books is a twist on the Bilderverbot and the work which logs both religious reverence and elegiac meditation. It makes us ask the question, what is the appropriate and suitable mode of remembering the Holocaust? Is it possible to not to approach this subject as sacred or solemn? Spiegelman transgresses the conventions of Holocaust representation while also elevating the medium of the comic book from its low or popular cultural status. In his hand, the comic book, as a form of mass culture, becomes a medium of telling the history of mass murder. The book is based on Vladek Spiegelman's taped memoirs, as well as other primary materials such as the images of the Auschwitz album, the drawings of concentration camp inmates, and Burke White's photographs. And here I'm showing you some of these images, and that's also kind of, this is why I started with primary documents, this lecture, because I wanted you to have a kind of understanding of this kind of image inventory. And here is something out of Maus, obviously, which kind of rephrases or quotes or appropriates Margaret Burke White's very famous photograph of the political prisoners. And here is one photograph representing or showing the gates of Auschwitz with the notorious inscription Arbeit macht frei, that is, work makes you free. And here's a recreation of the gate from Spiegelman's Mouse book. Fully aware that the scope of Holocaust is beyond imagination and it testing the limits of human suffering, Spiegelman chose to replace humans with animals. Doing so, he referred to the talking animals of both comic books and Disney pictures, as well as to the long tradition of animals in political allegories from the fables of antiquity to George Orwell's Animal Farm, which was published in 1945. Jews are mice, Germans are cats, Americans are dogs, and Poles are pigs. Spiegelman also declared that he chose pigs in good faith because of their resemblance to the famous American cartoon characters like Miss Piggy and Porky Pig. So it's not an entirely kind of pejorative, you know, analogy to depict them. Animal masks also function as devices against creating social stereotypes and recalling Bertolt Brecht's Verfremdung effect or the defamiliarization. They also function as a kind of distancing device. As Spiegelman explained, and I'll quote, ultimately what the book is about is the commonality of human beings. It's crazy to divide things down along nationalistic or racial or religious lines. These metaphors, which are meant to self-destruct in my book, and I think they do self-destruct, and they still have a residual force and still get people worked up over them. End of quote. Mouse is not only about the Holocaust, it also provides a history of its own making, recounting the difficulties involved in the father-son relationship in the ritual of second-generation listening, and thus it also becomes a document of what Marianne Hirsch, a scholar, called post-memory. The son asks the father, who reluctantly answers. He gives voice to the father as in a symbolic act. Spiegelman tells and his son represents the stories of everyday life before, in, and after the camp, retelling small occurrences of life and death, the banality of it all, showing us what Jean-François Lyotard called petit récit. And this petit récit is very similar to what Boltanski wanted to recall or evoke in his installation, the small memory, the little memory, right? And here you can see one of the images taken out of Mouse, which shows this little memory. And this is the pre-war years. This is before the camp, even before the ghetto. This is the story of Arch Spiegelman's mother and father as they met. And here is the dad kind of, you know, obviously kind of remembering, recalling his youth and mentioning that, you know, he looked like Rudolph Valentino. So no wonder that he was very successful with the ladies, including including Lucia Greenberg, Art Spiegelman's mother, Vladek Spiegelman's first wife. And the second image, again, deals with this little memory, the Petit Récit, but takes us to already to the camp. We are already in Auschwitz, and what you see is how Vladek, Art Spiegelman's father, learned, you know, shoemaking, kind of, you know, the shoemaking business, which turned out to be one of his means of survival, the camps. Through the struggle with the father, Maus reveals the border between private and public, contemplating what can be told and what should remain unsaid. And here you can see a couple of images, kind of, which are enlarged from a page. The history of the father and the history of remembering overlaps. And here you can see a kind of a conversation when Vladek and Art Spiegelman are arguing about whether mentioning or talking about things. What Vladek told to Artie, but he also asked him to not to represent these events in the books finally. And what happens, of course, Artie promises to Vladek, his father, that of course I will leave these out, these occurrences or stories, kind of private stories, and of course they are in the book. So he didn't leave them out. That's again kind of, you know, yet another twist with self-reflection, with the kind of the whole meta-narrative underlying the book. And the next image is kind of relates to what I just mentioned, that the actual story of, you know, Vladek, his private life, then before the ghetto, then the camp, is constantly kind of, it appears simultaneously with the time and the place of the storytelling itself. So here we are in a camp, and the next piece and the same page takes us to Rego Park, Queens, where he recalls and retells the story to his son. The chronology of Vladek's story is interrupted by the events of the camp. Neither linear narratives nor clear vantage points occur. What we see and read, similarly to memories and traces of trauma, are always multiple and fractured. The alternating stories told and witnessed by Vladek and his contemporary life in Rego Park, Queens, and Florida, as told and witnessed by the son, Artie, bring together past and present, father and son, language and image, manifest and latent, memory and forgetting. It is both a biography of Vladek and an autobiography of Artie, a tragic and a comic book, a history and a tale. Maus is also deeply anti-heroic. It opposes sentimental portraiture of the father as a victim and does not automatically grant moral grandeur and dignity to the survivor. Vladek is neither idolized nor idealized. In Maus, he appears as a bad husband. This is the second wife, Mala, and Artie talking about Vladek. A penny pitcher, and also as a racist who has racist trends against black people, African Americans, quite often in the book. Through Maus's humor and suspense, horror and irony, Spiegelman's introduced rhetorical and pictorial qualities which we usually do not associate with the recollection of genocide and suffering, and thus challenged the precoded mode and established narratives of the Holocaust. That's the last thing, and here it is. The Polish artist Zbigniew Libera followed this path when in 1996 created Lego concentration camp set. During the 1980s, Libera worked with video and then launched his series of toy objects appropriating and altering such mass-produced children toys as those manufactured by Mattel. His series of seven boxes of Lego toys, I'm showing you them here, initially sponsored by the Danish toy company Lego, reflect on the commodification of historical trauma and its collective memory. The boxes contain buildings and gallows, inmate and guard dolls, pieces of barbed wire, and crematoria. One of the small boxes is filled with the belongings of the inmates. I'm showing you, this is not the box itself, but you can see those belongings there, kind of put in their place, when played with. And I think that's the, yeah. In the summer of 1997, the controversial boxes were scheduled to appear in the Polish pavilion at the Venice Biennale. Jan Stanislav Wojciechowski, the curator of the exhibition, decided to only reproduce them in the catalogue, as a result of which Libero, the artist, cancelled his participation in the exhibition. 5 years later, however, in the spring of 2002, Libero's work was on view at the Jewish Museum's Mirroring Evil, Nazi Imagery, Recent Art exhibition here in New York. The exhibition was created by Norman Kleeblatt, and as some of you might recall, it's created quite a stir, not entirely independently from works such as Libero's here. Libero's works brings into play mass-produced images of remembrance, as well as the idea of mass destruction, play and death, the fantasy of the game, and the reality of the camps. In a Warholian vein, and I'm referring here to Andy Warhol's series, the 1964 series of images, which is called Deaths and Disasters, Libero portrays consumption and entertainment as a deferral, as well as an inability of facing death and loss. Through offering the viewer to play the game, he also frames the spectator as a potential accomplice, camp builder, and participant. Thus, he puts us into the role of not the victim, but the perpetrator. Another possible way to think about Libero's work is to connect it to diverse forms of Nazi propaganda, such as the 1936 board game, Juden raus, or Jews out. Seen from this angle, as Norman Kleebot remarks in the catalogue of the Mirroring Evil show, and I will quote, the work, Libero's work, creates a parallel between brainwashing tactics of the Nazis and commodification, end of quote. When played by children, games are also vehicles of social conditioning. Toys are them, or toys are us. Children learn through playing, and it is through playing that they learn how to hate, and when adults, how to turn playing violence into not just playing it anymore. Yet, many of Libero's critics believe that his work did none of these things, did not try to frame in a new way the collective trauma of Holocaust and the remembrance kind of industry of Holocaust, but only desecrated and trivialized the Holocaust and its memory, modeling it as a children's play and offering it as a demeaning joke. Although it operates in an entirely different matrix, Rachel Whiteread's Holocaust Monument in Vienna, here, also known as Nameless Library, did not escape controversies and heated debates either. Erected at a Judenplatz, Whiteread's works in Vienna, Judenplatz, that is the, you know, the Jewish square, Whiteread's work was the first Holocaust memorial of the city known for its once large Jewish population. I just needed to say this because it's a rather surprising fact, right, that the first Holocaust memorial in Vienna was dedicated only in 2000. Okay. The British sculptor and the 1994 Turner Prize winner won the international competition to design a monument in 1995. Originally scheduled to be finished by November 9, 1996, the 58th anniversary of Kristallnacht, it was dedicated only 4 years later on October 25, 2000. The 12 feet high, 24 feet wide, and 30 feet long work is built over the remnants of a synagogue that was burned down in 1921. It is a giant concrete block imitating the inside kind of, you know, the turnout inside that library. And here you can see in a minute. The imprint of the books arranged in rows with their spines facing in line structures the wall. And this will help you to understand how does it work, because here you can actually see the spine of the book and the cover of the book, and you can understand it's a negative cast. So it's like a library wall turned inside out. Around its base, there's another corner. Of course, the row of the books, in a very interesting way, just the indentation, the rhythmic sequencing indentation also recalls the classical Greek order of columns. Think about the Doric columns in a horizontal way, thus kind of, you know, connecting the monument back to Greek temples and kind of coming up with a transhistorical architectural form. And here you can see the base of this nameless library or Holocaust memorial, when you can see that You know, the numbers and the days that 65,000 Austrian Jews were killed by the Nazis between 38 and 45. And around the monuments base, you can see the names of those camps in which the Jews and the Holocaust, Austrian Holocaust, Holocaust victims were murdered. First delayed by the archaeological excavations of the medieval synagogue underneath the construction site, then by the local residents who protested that the work was unsightly, as if a Holocaust memorial should be beautiful. This is what explains partially why it took 4 years her to build it. On the other hand, later locals also claimed that the monument will take away their parking spaces. The Jewish community of Vienna resented it because, I will quote, because it only represented the stereotypes of Jews as being the people of the book. And the last phase of the monument, the building of the monument, was also kind of, you know, made a little bit complicated by a new government in Austria. That was the time when Jörg Haider's government took office. And obviously, this right-wing government was not very keen on the finishing the completion of the monument. And I will quote a little bit, just one sentence from Weitried. Everybody was so excited that it should happen under their political umbrella, said Weitried, bringing to mind the question of how acts of commemoration both make and appropriate history. The question of who has the right to speak and remember is being complemented by another who has the power to do so. Neither soothing nor sublime, Weitried's monument was often compared, and negatively so, to a bunker. As the artist said, I saw a lot of the bunkers around the Atlantic Wall in France, and I did not want to give the city of Vienna something beautiful. I wanted to give them something that they had to think about and that wasn't ugly, but that had a presence, and quite a severe presence in the city. People have to look at it, and it's not an easy thing to look at. End of quote. Simon Wiesenthal, who initiated the building of the monument, said at the dedication ceremony, this monument shouldn't be beautiful, it must hurt. End of quote. And indeed, it does. Both a tomb and a tombstone, an inaccessible archive, and an inapproachable library, the monument's concrete cube disrupts the architectural style of its surroundings. As the Jews of Vienna today, it looks out of place and out of time, looming over the Baroque square of Judenplatz as a hefty phantom of concrete. Weitried is best known for her negative cast, depicting objects and spaces and inverting negative and positive forms. From her first well-known work entitled House, a negative cast of a Victorian house in East London, to her most recent 1999 untitled, in parentheses, library, which actually we have here in MoMA, she always works with absence and loss, here in Vienna too. The titles of the books are unknown, and their content remains unrevealed. Their imprints, indexical traces, recall similar traces such as photographs or clothes, thus relating the work also to Boltanski's installations. What we see is one unmarked book after the other, as if dead corpses of victims in a mass grave. The library's double door is closed, and it has no doorknobs or handles. It is, as its maker described, quote-unquote, a blank library, one which is sealed from its own contents and forever silenced behind closed doors. The Vienna monument brings together the duty of commemoration, yet complies with the builder verbot. Looking at it, we cannot help but face our fundamental incapacity to understand how and why the catastrophe of the Holocaust took place. In a text called Memories of a Battle, the Italian writer Italo Calvino muses about his Second World War memories, according to the following. I continue to gaze into the valley bottom of memory, and my fear now is that as soon as a memory forms, it immediately takes on the wrong light, mannered, sentimental, as war and youth always are. It becomes a piece of narrative written in the style of the time, which can't tell us how things really were, but only how we thought we saw them or we said them. I don't know if I am destroying the past or saving it. The past is hidden in that besieged village. End of quote. Relinquishing both salvation or recovery, Weitried's Vienna monument shows that the past is always hidden and it is always in front of our very eyes. Thank you very much. Do you have, yes, please, questions, comments?
Are all of Rachel Whitehead's sculptures made out of books?
No, but she also made, you know, as I showed you the house, she made a negative cast of a smaller object like a mattress. She also made negative. The library, you know, appeared in her work while he was working on this project, and then later she created Untitled 1999, which we also have here in the museum.
Where are her works in the museum?
Right now they are not on view, but when we reopened, I believe, the very first installation of the contemporary galleries on the second floor of the museum contained or showed, put on display, library in a different installation. It was a little room, kind of, and the walls were aligned with this negative cast of books.
She had that there on the water tower, didn't she?
Yeah, and of course, thank you very much for reminding me. We have the water towers. If you go to the garden, I know it's very cold, but we have the water tower cast, which is a resin, a transparent resin cast of one of those new typical New York water towers, what you can see in the Soho. It was originally commissioned to be in the Soho in the late 1990s, then MoMA purchased it, and right now it's on the roof of the first house of the museum. So if you go to the garden, look up on top of the building, which is above the restaurant, you will see it. Yes?
Did any of these artists actually suffer from the Holocaust?
No, as I said in the introduction, they are all, oh sorry, yeah, they are, I made this distinction between primary documents, which were produced by those who were either perpetrators or survivors or the victims of the Holocaust, and the second group of works, which I discussed in today's lecture, were done by all contemporary artists who are either secondary or tertiary witnesses, like most of the people who, you know, who are around us.
Is Rachel Whitehead Jewish?
No, that's also interesting and quite important that not every one of the artists are Jewish.
Art Spiegelman
is Jewish, yeah, but you know Rachel Whitehead is not Jewish, so yeah.
What year were the toys put together?
Excuse me?
The year.
The toy, the Lego camp set by Zbigniew Libera, 1996. And they were, you know, they were on view in New York in 2002. Any other question? Yes, please.
Yeah, it was interesting when you spoke about the children. Mm-hmm. You used the word die, which is a very nice word, like you die of a disease, as opposed to being murdered.
Yeah, I think that was the only occasion when I said died. Usually I use the word murdered, I believe, yeah.
Okay, I just figured you gave the Nazis too much credit in terms of their form of killing people by saying they died.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I'm trying to pay to pay very specific attention to the fact of saying murdered repeatedly, but obviously I forget to say that at one time. Yes.
Could you say something one thing about the memory effect difference between the memory effect?
Yeah, memory effect exactly kind of relates to this question that most of the artists who deal with the memory of the Holocaust could not be primary witnesses. That, you know, memory is never exact, memory is never precise, memory is always, that's the very complicated relation between memory and history, that memory always rewrites and falsifies history, and it's a fantastically interesting and very complicated relation between them. And what Dora Appel tries to say that it is an effect of memory. It is not personal memory, not a personal experience, not based on primary witnessing. So it's Holocaust effect because it does not depict the Holocaust. It deals with the trauma of the Holocaust. And it's memory effect because it's not based on the memory of a primary witness. But as memories always are, or mostly are, it's already mediated through experiences of others, retelling, books, images, and so on. So not direct, in a way, yeah.
I notice you refer to the Nazis rather than the Germans. Is that intentional? Do
yes.
Do
they
prefer that they...
Yes, absolutely.
They, you know, they not be identified?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Of course.
The Germans were, for the most part, Nazis.
Yes, but I believe that this was the debate in the 1980s in Germany. The historical strike was just about that if we accept the idea of collective guilt, i.e. all Germans are Nazis, we end up being replicating the same racist kind of construction, what was directed to begin with toward the Jews, right? So I think that the very idea of collective guilt, which sent people into camps in Nazi Germany, it sent people into camps in the Gulag, in the Soviet Union. You know, 30 million people were sent to the Gulags. So genocide, ethnic cleansing, is always based on this racist argument that there is such thing as the Jews, the Kurds, the Tartars, whoever is responsible collectively for some sort of guilt, right? That for some sort of sin. So it's very, very kind of, you know, conscious decision on my behalf to not to say Germans. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, of course. Well, let's hope it does. Okay, any other question? No, then thank you very much for coming. Thank you.